was essential to civilized society. So-called democratic Athens in the time of Pericles enslaved 35% of its population, as did the Roman Republic. Slaves have always been a major booty in wartime, and stateless people of all races were vulnerable to capture. The word slave comes from Slav, because, as the dictionary informs us, Slavic people were widely captured and enslaved during the Middle Ages. States and armed forces, when they were not used as enslaving devices, were used as enslavement prevention devices, as we are reminded by the lyric, "Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves, Britons never, never, never shall be slaves." Well before Africans were enslaved by Europeans, they were enslaved by other Africans, as well as by Islamic states in North Africa and the Middle East. Some of those states did not abolish legal slavery until recently. Qatar in 1952, Saudi Arabia and Yemen in 1962, Mauritania in 1980. For captives in war, slavery was often a better fate than the alternative, massacre, and in many societies, slavery shaded into milder forms of servitude, employment, military service, and occupational guilds. But violence is inherent to the definition of slavery. If a person did all the work of a slave but had the option of quitting at any time without being physically restrained or punished, we would not call him a slave. And this violence was often a regular part of a slave's life. Exodus chapter 21, verses 20 and 21 decrees, "When a slave owner strikes a male or female slave with a rod, and the slave dies immediately, the owner shall be punished. But if the slave survives for a day or two, there is no punishment, for the slave is the owner's property." Slaves' lack of ownership of their own bodies left even the better treated ones vulnerable to vicious exploitation. Women in harems were perpetual rape victims, and the men who guarded them, eunuchs, had their testicles, or in the case of black eunuchs, their entire genitalia, hacked off with a knife and cauterized with boiling butter, so they would not bleed to death from the wound. The African slave trade in particular was among the most brutal chapters in human history. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, at least 1.5 million Africans died in transatlantic slave ships, chained together in stifling, filth-ridden holds, and, as one observer noted, "those who remain to meet the shore present a picture of wretchedness language cannot express." Millions more perished in forced marches through jungles and deserts to slave markets on the coast or in the Middle East. Slave traders treated their cargo according to the business model of ice merchants, who accept that a certain proportion of their goods will be lost in transport. At least 17 million Africans, and perhaps as many as 65 million, died in the slave trade. The slave trade not only killed people in transit, but by providing a continuous stream of bodies, it encouraged slaveholders to work their slaves to death and replace them with new ones. But even the slaves who were kept in relatively good health lived in the shadow of flogging, rape, mutilation, forced separation from family members, and summary execution. Slaveholders in many times have manumitted their slaves, often in their wills, as they became personally close to them. In some places, such as Europe in the Middle Ages, slavery gave way to serfdom and sharecropping when it became cheaper to tax people than to keep them in bondage, or when weak states could not enforce a slave owner's property rights. But a mass movement against chattel slavery as an institution arose for the first time in the 18th century and rapidly pushed it to near extinction. Why did people eventually forswear the ultimate labor-saving device? Historians have long debated the extent to which the abolition of slavery was driven by economics or by humanitarian concerns. At one point, the economic explanation seemed compelling. In 1776, Adam Smith reasoned that slavery must be less efficient than paid employment because only the latter was a positive-sum game. "The work done by slaves, though it appears to cost only their maintenance, is in the end the dearest of any. A person who can acquire no property can have no other interest but to eat as much and to labor as little as possible. Whatever work he does beyond what is sufficient to purchase his own maintenance can be squeezed out of him by violence only, and not by any interest of his own. The political scientist John Mueller points out, Smith's view garnered adherence, but not, as it happens, among slave owners. That is, either Smith was wrong, or slaveholders were bad businessmen. Some economists, such as Robert Fogel and Stanley Engerman, have concluded that Smith was at least partly wrong in the case of the antebellum South, which had a reasonably efficient economy for the time. And Southern slavery, of course, did not gradually give way to more cost-effective production techniques, but had to be obliterated by war and by law. It took guns and laws to end slavery in much of the rest of the world as well. Britain, once among the most exuberant slave-trading nations, outlawed the slave trade in 1807 and abolished slavery throughout the empire in 1833. By the 1840s, it was jawboning other countries to end their participation in the slave trade, backed up by economic sanctions and by almost a quarter of the Royal Navy. Most historians have concluded that Britain's policing of the abolition of slavery was driven by humanitarian motives. Locke undermined the moral basis for slavery in his 1689 work, Two Treatises on Government. And though he and many of his intellectual descendants hypocritically profited from the institution, their advocacy of liberty, equality, and the universal rights of man let a genie out of the bottle and made it increasingly awkward for anyone to justify the practice. Many of the Enlightenment writers who inveighed against torture on humanitarian grounds, such as Jacques-Pierre Brisson in France, applied the same logic to oppose slavery. They were joined by Quakers, who founded the influential Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade in 1787, and by preachers, scholars, free blacks, former slaves, and politicians. At the same time, many politicians and preachers defended slavery, citing the Bible's approval of the practice, the inferiority of the African race, the value of preserving the Southern way of life, and a paternalistic concern that freed slaves could not survive on their own. But these rationalizations withered under intellectual and moral scrutiny. The intellectual argument held that it was indefensible to allow one person to own another, arbitrarily excluding him from the community of decision-makers whose interests were negotiated in the social contract. As Jefferson put it, the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately. The moral revulsion was stimulated by first-person accounts of what it was like to be a slave. Some were autobiographies, like The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Alada Equiano, the African, written by himself, 1789, and Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, 1845. Even more influential was a work of fiction, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Life Among the Lowly, 1852. The novel depicted a wrenching episode in which mothers were separated from their children, and another in which the kindly Tom was beaten to death for refusing to flog other slaves. The book sold 300,000 copies and was a catalyst for the abolitionist movement. According to legend, when Abraham Lincoln met Stowe in 1862, he said, "So you're the little woman who started this great war." In 1865, after the most destructive war in American history, slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. Many countries had abolished it before that time, and France had the dubious distinction of abolishing it twice, first in the wake of the French Revolution in 1794, and again after Napoleon had restored it in 1802 during the Second Republic in 1848. The rest of the world quickly followed suit. Many encyclopedias provide timelines of the abolition of slavery, which differ slightly in how they delineate territories and what they count as abolition. but they all show the same pattern, an explosion of abolition proclamations beginning in the late 18th century. Closely related to slavery is the practice of debt bondage. Beginning in biblical and classical times, people who defaulted on their loans could be enslaved, imprisoned, or executed. The word draconian comes from the Greek lawgiver Draco, who in 621 BCE codified laws governing the enslavement of debtors. Shylock's right to cut a pound of flesh from Antonio in The Merchant of Venice is another reminder of the practice. By the 16th century, defaulters were no longer enslaved or executed, but they filled up debtors' prisons by the thousands. Sometimes they were charged for food, despite being broke, and had to survive on what they could beg from passers-by through the windows of the jail. In early 19th century America, thousands of people, including many women, languished in debtors' prisons, half of them for debts of less than $10. In the 1830s, a reform movement sprang up, which, like the anti-slavery movement, appealed to both reason and emotion. A congressional committee argued that it ran contrary to the principles of justice to give the creditor, in any case whatever, power over the body of his debtor. The committee also noted that if all the victims of oppression were presented to our view in one congregated mass, with all the train of wives, children, and friends involved in the same ruin, they would exhibit a spectacle at which humanity would shudder. Debt bondage was abolished by almost every American state between 1820 and 1840, and by most European governments in the 1860s and 1870s. The history of our treatment of debtors, Payne notes, illustrates the mysterious process in which violence has declined in every sphere of life. Western societies have gone from enslaving and executing debtors to imprisoning them, and then to seizing their assets to repay the debt. Even the seizure of assets, he points out, is a kind of violence. When John buys groceries on credit and later refuses to pay for them, he has not used force. If the grocer goes to court and gets the police to seize John's car or bank account, the grocer and police are the ones who are initiating the use of force. And because it is a form of violence, even if people don't usually think of it that way, this practice too has been in decline. The trend in bankruptcy law has been away from punishing debtors or squeezing assets out of them and toward giving them the opportunity of a fresh start. In many states, a debtor's house, car, retirement accounts, and spouse's assets are protected, and when a person or company declares bankruptcy, they can write off many debts with impunity. In the old days of debtors' prisons, people might have predicted that this lenience would spell the demise of capitalism, which depends on the repayment of loans. But the commercial ecosystem evolved workarounds for this loss of leverage. Credit checks, credit ratings, loan insurance, and credit cards are just some of the ways that economic life continued after borrowers could no longer be deterred by the threat of legal coercion. An entire category of violence evaporated, and mechanisms that carried out the same function materialized without anyone realizing that that was what was happening. Slavery and other forms of bondage, of course, have not been obliterated from the face of the earth. As a result of recent publicity about the trafficking of people for labor and prostitution, one sometimes hears the statistically illiterate and morally obtuse claim that nothing has changed since the 18th century, as if there were no difference between a clandestine practice in a few parts of the world and an authorized practice everywhere in the world. Moreover, modern human trafficking, as heinous as it is, cannot be equated with the horrors of the African slave trade. As David Feingold, who initiated the UNESCO Trafficking Statistics Project in 2003, notes of today's hotbeds of trafficking, "The identification of trafficking with chattel slavery, in particular the transatlantic slave trade, is tenuous at best. In the 18th and 19th centuries, African slaves were kidnapped or captured in war. They were shipped to the New World into lifelong servitude, from which they or their children could rarely escape. In contrast, although some trafficking victims are kidnapped, for most, trafficking is migration gone terribly wrong. Most leave their homes voluntarily, though sometimes coerced by circumstance, in search of a materially better or more exciting life. Along the way, they become enmeshed in a coercive and exploitative situation. However, this situation rarely persists for life, nor do the trafficked become a permanent or hereditary caste. Feingold also notes that the numbers of trafficking victims reported by activist groups and repeated by journalists and non-governmental organizations are usually pulled out of thin air and inflated for their advocacy value. Nonetheless, even the activists recognize the fantastic progress that has been made. A statement by Kevin Bales, president of Free the Slaves, though it begins with a dubious statistic, puts the issue in perspective. While the real number of slaves is the largest there has ever been, it is also probably the smallest proportion of the world population ever in slavery. Today, we don't have to win the legal battle. There's a law against it in every country. We don't have to win the economic argument. No economy is dependent on slavery, unlike in the 19th century when whole industries could have collapsed. And we don't have to win the moral argument. No one is trying to justify it anymore. The Age of Reason and the Enlightenment brought many violent institutions to a sudden end. Two others had more staying power and were indulged in large parts of the world for another two centuries: tyranny and war between major states. Though the first systematic movements to undermine these institutions were nearly strangled in the crib and began to predominate only in our lifetimes, they originated in the grand change in thoughts and sensibilities that make up the humanitarian revolution. So I will introduce them here. Despotism and political violence. A government, according to the famous characterization by the sociologist Max Weber, is an institution that holds a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. Governments, then, are institutions that by their very nature are designed to carry out violence. Ideally, this violence is held in reserve as a deterrent to criminals and invaders, but for millennia, most governments showed no such restraint and indulged in violence exuberantly. All of the first complex states were despotisms in the sense of an exercised right of heads of societies to murder their subjects arbitrarily and with impunity. Evidence for despotism, Laura Betzig has shown, may be found in the records of the Babylonians, Hebrews, Imperial Romans, Samoans, Fijians, Khmer, Natchez, Aztecs, Incas, and nine African kingdoms. Despots put their power to good Darwinian use by living in luxury and enjoying the services of enormous harems. According to a report from the early days of the British colonization of India, a party given by the Mughal governor of Surat was rudely interrupted when the host fell into a sudden rage and ordered all the dancing girls to be decapitated on the spot, to the stupefaction of the English guests. They could afford to be stupefied only because the mother country had recently put its own despotism behind it. When Henry VIII got into various of his bad moods, he executed two wives, several of their suspected lovers, many of his own advisers, including Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell, the Bible translator William Tyndale, and tens of thousands of others. The power of despots to kill on a whim is the backdrop to stories told throughout the world. The wise King Solomon proposed to resolve a maternity dispute by butchering the baby in question. The backdrop to the Scheherazade story is a Persian king who murdered a new bride every day. The legendary king Narasimha Dev in Orissa, India, demanded that exactly 1,200 artisans build a temple in exactly 12 years, or all would be executed. And in Dr. Seuss's The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, the protagonist is nearly beheaded for being unable to remove his hat in the presence of the king. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. And in most of human history, political murder, a challenger killing a leader and taking his place, was the primary mechanism for the transfer of power. A political murderer differs from the modern assassin who tries to make a political statement wants to go down in the history books or is stark raving mad. Instead, he is typically a member of the political elite, kills a leader to take over his position, and counts on his accession to be recognized as legitimate. Kings Saul, David, and Solomon were all targets or perpetrators of murder plots, and Julius Caesar was one of the 34 Roman emperors, out of the total of 49 that reigned until the division of the empire, who were killed by guards, high officials, or members of their own families. Manuel Eisner has calculated that between 600 and 1800 CE, about 1 in 8 European monarchs was murdered in office, mostly by noblemen, and that a third of the killers took over the throne. Political leaders not only kill each other, but commonly commit mass violence against their citizenries. They may torture them, imprison them, execute them, starve them, or work them to death in pharaonic construction projects. Rummel estimates that governments killed 133 million people before the 20th century, and the total may be as high as 625 million. So once raiding and feuding have been brought under control in a society, the greatest opportunity for reducing violence is reducing government violence. By the 17th and 18th centuries, many countries had begun to cut back on tyranny and political murder. Between the early Middle Ages and 1800, Eisner calculates, the European regicide rate declined fivefold, particularly in Western and Northern Europe. A famous example of this change is the fate of the two Stuart kings who locked horns with the English Parliament. In 1649, Charles I was beheaded, but in 1688, his son James II was deposed bloodlessly in the Glorious Revolution. Even after attempting to stage a coup, he was merely forced into exile. By 1776, the American revolutionaries had defined despotism down to the level of taxing tea and quartering soldiers. At the same time that governments were gradually becoming less tyrannical, thinkers were seeking a principled way to reel in government violence to the minimum necessary. It began with a conceptual revolution. Instead of taking government for granted as an organic part of the society, or as the local franchise of God's rule over his kingdom, people began to think of a government as a gadget, a piece of technology invented by humans for the purpose of enhancing their collective welfare. Of course, governments had never been deliberately invented, and they had been in place long before history was recorded, so this way of thinking required a considerable leap of the imagination. Thinkers such as Hobbes, Spinoza, Locke, and Rousseau, and later Jefferson, Hamilton, James Madison, and John Adams, fantasized about what life was like in a state of nature, and played out thought experiments about what a group of rational actors would come up with to better their lives. The resulting institutions would clearly bear no resemblance to the theocracies and hereditary monarchies of the day. It's hard to imagine a plausible simulation of rational actors in a state of nature choosing an arrangement that would give them the divine right of kings, l'état c'est moi, or inbred 10-year-olds ascending to the throne. Instead, the government would serve at the pleasure of the people it governed. Its power to keep them all in awe, as Hobbes put it, was not a license to brutalize its citizens in pursuit of its own interests, but only a mandate to implement the agreement. That a man be willing, when others are so too, to lay down this right to all things, and be contented with so much liberty against other men, as he would allow other men against himself. It's fair to say that Hobbes himself didn't think through the problem deeply enough. He imagined that somehow people would vest authority in a sovereign or a committee once and for all at the dawn of time, and thereafter it would embody their interests so perfectly that they would never have reason to question it. One only has to think of a typical American congressman or a member of the British royal family, to say nothing of a generalissimo or a commissar, to see how this would be a recipe for disaster. Real-life leviathans are human beings, with all the greed and foolishness we should expect of a specimen of Homo sapiens. Locke recognized that people in power would be tempted to exempt themselves from the obedience to the laws they make and suit the law, both in its making and its execution, to their own private wish, and thereby come to have a distinct interest from the rest of the community, contrary to the end of society and government. He called for a separation between the legislative and executive branches of government, and for the citizenry to reserve the power to throw out a government that was no longer carrying out its mandate. This line of thinking was taken to the next level by the heirs of Hobbes and Locke, who hashed out a design for American constitutional government after years of study and debate. They were obsessed with the problem of how a ruling body composed of fallible humans could wield enough force to prevent citizens from preying on each other without arrogating so much that it would become the most destructive predator of all. As Madison wrote, "If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary." And so Locke's ideal of the separation of powers was written into the design of the new government, because ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The result was the division of government into executive, judicial, and legislative branches, the Federalist system, in which authority was divided between the states and the national government, and periodic elections to force the government to give some attention to the wishes of the populace and to transfer power in an orderly and peaceable way. Perhaps most important, the government was given a circumscribed mission statement to secure the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of its citizens with their consent, and in the form of the Bill of Rights, a set of lines it could not cross in its use of violence against them. Yet another innovation of the American system was its explicit recognition of the pacifying effects of positive-sum cooperation. The ideal of gentle commerce was implemented in the Commerce, Contract, and Takings clauses of the Constitution, which prevented the government from getting too much in the way of reciprocal exchanges among its citizens. The forms of democracy that were tried out in the 18th century were what you might expect of the 1.0 release of a complex new technology. The English implementation was weak tea, the French implementation an unmitigated disaster, and the American implementation had a flaw that is best captured in the actor Ice-T's impression of Thomas Jefferson reviewing a draft of the Constitution. "Let's see. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, you can own niggers. Looks good to me." But the value of the early designs for democracy was their upgradability. Not only did they carve out zones, however restricted, that were free of inquisitions, cruel punishments, and despotic authority, but they contained the means of their own expansion. The statement, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," however hypocritical at the time, was a built-in rights widener that could be invoked to end slavery 67 years later, and other forms of racial coercion a century after that. The idea of democracy, once loosed on the world, would eventually infect larger and larger portions of it, and as we shall see, would turn out to be one of the greatest violence reduction technologies since the appearance of government itself. Major War. For most of human history, the justification for war was pithily captured by Julius Caesar, "I came, I saw, I conquered." Conquest was what governments did. Empires rose, empires fell, entire populations were annihilated or enslaved, and no one seemed to think there was anything wrong with it. The historical figures who earned the honorific so-and-so the great were not great artists, scholars, doctors, or inventors, people who enhanced human happiness or wisdom. They were dictators who conquered large swaths of territory and the people in them. If Hitler's luck had held out a bit longer, he probably would have gone down in history as Adolf the Great. Even today, the standard histories of war teach the reader a great deal about horses and armor and gunpowder, but give only the vaguest sense that immense numbers of people were killed and maimed in these extravaganzas. At the same time, there have always been eyes that zoom in to the scale of the individual women and men affected by war, and that have seen its moral dimension. In the 5th century BCE, the Chinese philosopher Mo Zi, the founder of a rival religion to Confucianism and Taoism, noted, "To kill one man is to be guilty of a capital crime. To kill 10 men is to increase the guilt tenfold. To kill 100 men is to increase it 100-fold. This the rulers of the earth all recognize, and yet when it comes to the greatest crime, waging war on another state, they praise it. If a man on seeing a little black were to say it is black, but on seeing a lot of black were to say it is white, it would be clear that such a man could not distinguish black and white. So those who recognize a small crime as such, but do not recognize the wickedness of the greatest crime of all, the waging of war on another state, but actually praise it, cannot distinguish right and wrong." The occasional Western seer, too, paid homage to the ideal of peace. The prophet Isaiah expressed the hope that they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Jesus preached, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also." Though Christianity began as a pacifist movement, things went downhill in 312 CE, when the Roman ruler Constantine had a vision of a flaming cross in the sky, with the words, "In this sign thou shalt conquer," and converted the Roman Empire to this militant version of the faith. Periodic expressions of pacifism or war weariness over the next millennium did nothing to stop the nearly constant state of warfare. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the premises of international law during the Middle Ages were as follows. In the absence of an agreed state of truce or peace, war was the basic state of international relations, even between independent Christian communities. 2. Unless exceptions were made by means of individual safe conduct or treaty, rulers saw themselves entitled to treat foreigners at their absolute discretion. 3. The high seas were no man's land, where anyone might do as he pleased. In the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, wars broke out between European countries at a rate of about 3 new wars a year. The moral arguments against war are irrefutable. As the musician Edwin Starr put it, "War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. War means tears to thousands of mothers' eyes when their sons go to fight and lose their lives." But for most of history, this argument has not caught on, for 2 reasons. One is the other guy problem. If a nation decides not to learn war anymore, but its neighbor continues to do so, its pruning hooks will be no match for the neighbor's spears, and it may find itself at the wrong end of an invading army. This was the fate of Carthage against the Romans, India against Muslim invaders, the Cathars against the French and the Catholic Church, and the various countries stuck between Germany and Russia at many times in their history. Pacifism is also vulnerable to militaristic forces within a country. When a country is embroiled in a war or on the verge of one, its leaders have trouble distinguishing a pacifist from a coward or a traitor. The Anabaptists are one of many pacifist sects that have been persecuted throughout history. To gain traction, anti-war sentiments have to infect many constituencies at the same time. And they have to be grounded in economic and political institutions, so that the war-adverse outlook doesn't depend on everyone's deciding to become and stay virtuous. It was in the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment that pacifism evolved from a pious but ineffectual sentiment to a movement with a practicable agenda. One way to drive home the futility and evil of war is to tap the distancing power of satire. A moralizer can be mocked, a polemicist can be silenced, but a satirist can get the same point across through stealth. By luring an audience into taking the perspective of an outsider, a fool, a foreigner, a traveler, a satirist can make them appreciate the hypocrisy of their own society and the flaws in human nature that foster it. If the audience gets the joke, if the readers or viewers lose themselves in the work, they have tacitly acceded to the author's deconstruction of a norm without anyone having had to rebuff it in so many words. Shakespeare's Falstaff, for example, delivers the finest analysis ever expressed of the concept of honor, the source of so much violence over the course of human history. Prince Hal has urged him into battle, saying, "Thou owest God a death." Falstaff muses, "'Tis not due yet. I would be loath to pay him before his day. What need I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter. Honor pricks me on. Yea, but how if honor prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honor set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honor hath no skill in surgery, then? No. What is honor? A word. What is that word honor? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible, then? Yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore I'll none of it. Honor is a mere scutcheon. And so ends my catechism. Detraction will not suffer it. More than a century later, in 1759, Samuel Johnson imagined a Quebec Indian chief commenting on the art and regularity of European war in a speech to his people during the Seven Years' War. They have a written law among them, of which they boast is derived from him who made the earth and sea, and by which they profess to believe that man will be made happy when life shall forsake him. Why is not this law communicated to us? It is concealed because it is violated. For how can they preach it to an Indian nation, when I am told that one of its first precepts forbids them to do to others what they would not that others should do to them? The sons of rapacity have now drawn their swords upon each other and referred their claims to the decision of war. Let us look unconcerned upon the slaughter and remember that the death of every European delivers the country from a tyrant and a robber. For what is the claim of either nation but the claim of the vulture to the leveret, of the tiger to the fawn? A leveret is a young hare. Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, 1726, was the quintessential exercise in the shifting of vantage points, in this case from the Lilliputian to the Brobdingnagian. Swift has Gulliver describe the recent history of his homeland to the king of Brobdingnag. "He was perfectly astonished with the historical account I gave him of our affairs during the last century, protesting it was only a heap of conspiracies, rebellions, murders, massacres, revolutions, banishments, the very worst effects that avarice, faction, hypocrisy, perfidiousness, cruelty, rage, madness, hatred, envy, lust, malice, or ambition could produce. As for yourself," continued the king, "who have spent the greatest part of your life in traveling, I am well disposed to hope you may hitherto have escaped many vices of your country. But by what I have gathered from your own relation, and the answers I have with much pain wringed and extorted from you, I cannot but conclude the bulk of your natives to be the most pernicious race of little odious vermin that nature ever suffered to crawl upon the surface of the earth." Satires appeared in France as well. In one of his Pensées, Blaise Pascal, 1623-62, imagined the following dialogue. "Why are you killing me for your own benefit? I am unarmed. Why do you not live on the other side of the water? My friend, if you lived on this side, I should be a murderer. But since you live on the other side, I am a hero, and it is just." Voltaire's Candide, 1759, was another novel that slipped scathing anti-war commentary into the mouth of a fictitious character, such as the following definition of war: "A million assassins in uniform, roaming from one end of Europe to the other, murder and pillage with discipline in order to earn their daily bread." Together with satires suggesting that war was hypocritical and contemptible, the 18th century saw the appearance of theories holding that it was irrational and avoidable. One of the foremost was gentle commerce, the theory that the positive-sum payoff of trade should be more appealing than the zero-sum or negative-sum payoff of war. Though the mathematics of game theory would not be available for another 200 years, the key idea could be stated easily enough in words. Why spend money and blood to invade a country and plunder its treasure when you can just buy it from them at less expense and sell them some of your own? The Abbé de Saint-Pierre, 1713, Montesquieu, 1748, Adam Smith, 1776, George Washington, 1788, and Immanuel Kant, 1795, were some of the writers who extolled free trade because it yoked the material interests of nations and thus encouraged them to value one another's well-being. As Kant put it, "The spirit of commerce sooner or later takes hold of every people, and it cannot exist side by side with war." Thus states find themselves compelled to promote the noble cause of peace, though not exactly from motives of morality. As they did with slavery, Quakers founded activist groups that opposed the institution of war. Though the sect's commitment to nonviolence sprang from its religious belief that God speaks through individual human lives, it didn't hurt the cause that they were influential businessmen rather than ascetic Luddites, having founded, among other concerns, Lloyd's of London, Barclays Bank, and the colony of Pennsylvania. The most remarkable anti-war document of the era was Kant's 1795 essay, Perpetual Peace. Kant was no dreamer. He began the essay with the self-deprecating confession that he took the title of his essay from the caption on an innkeeper's sign with a picture of a burial ground. He then laid out six preliminary steps toward perpetual peace, followed by three sweeping principles. The preliminary steps were that peace treaties should not leave open the option of war, that states should not absorb other states, that standing armies should be abolished, that governments should not borrow to finance wars, that a state should not interfere in the internal governance of another state, and that in war, states should avoid tactics that would undermine confidence in a future peace, such as assassinations, poisonings, and incitements to treason. More interesting were his definitive articles. Kant was a strong believer in human nature. Elsewhere he had written that, "From the crooked timber of humanity, no truly straight thing can be made." Thus he began from a Hobbesian premise: "The state of peace among men living side by side is not the natural state. The natural state is one of war. This does not always mean open hostilities, but at least an unceasing threat of war. A state of peace, therefore, must be established, for in order to be secured against hostility, it is not sufficient that hostilities simply not be committed, and unless this security is pledged to each by his neighbor, a thing that can occur only in a civil state, each may treat his neighbor, from whom he demands this security, as an enemy." He then outlined his three conditions for perpetual peace. The first is that states should be democratic. Kant himself preferred the term republican because he associated the word democracy with mob rule. What he had in mind was a government dedicated to freedom, equality, and the rule of law. Democracies are unlikely to fight each other, Kant argued, for two reasons. One is that a democracy is a form of government that by design, having sprung from the pure source of the concept of law, is built around nonviolence, A democratic government wields its power only to safeguard the rights of its citizens. Democracies, Kant reasoned, are apt to externalize this principle to their dealings with other nations, who are no more deserving of domination by force than are their own citizens. More important, democracies tend to avoid wars because the benefits of war go to a country's leaders, whereas the costs are paid by its citizens. In an autocracy, a declaration of war is the easiest thing in the world to decide upon, because war does not require of the ruler, who is the proprietor and not a member of the state, the least sacrifice of the pleasures of his table, the chase, his country houses, his court functions, and the like. He may, therefore, resolve on war as on a pleasure party for the most trivial reasons. But if the citizens are in charge, they will think twice about wasting their own money and blood on a foolish foreign adventure. Kant's second condition for perpetual peace was that the law of nations shall be founded on a federation of free states, a League of Nations, as he also called it. This federation, a kind of international Leviathan, would provide objective third-party adjudication of disputes, circumventing every nation's tendency to believe that it is always in the right. Just as individuals accede to a social contract in which they surrender some of their freedom to the state to escape the nastiness of anarchy, so it should be with states. For states, in their relation to each other, there cannot be any reasonable way out of the lawless condition which entails only war, except that they, like individual men, should give up their savage, lawless freedom, adjust themselves to the constraints of public law, and thus establish a continuously growing state consisting of various nations which will ultimately include all the nations of the world. Kant didn't have in mind a world government with a global army. He thought that international laws could be self-enforcing. The homage which each state pays, at least in words, to the concept of law, proves that there is slumbering in man an even greater moral disposition to become master of the evil principle in himself, which he cannot disclaim, and to hope for the same from others. The author of Perpetual Peace was, after all, the same man who proposed the categorical imperative, which stated that people should act so that the maxim of their action can be universalized. This is all starting to sound a bit starry-eyed, but Kant brought the idea back to earth by tying it to the spread of democracy. Each of two democracies can recognize the validity of the principles that govern the other. That sets them apart from theocracies, which are based on parochial faiths, and from autocracies, which are based on clans, dynasties, or charismatic leaders. In other words, if one state has reason to believe that a neighboring one organizes its political affairs in the same way that it does, because both have stumbled upon the same solution to the problem of government, then neither has to worry about the other one attacking. Neither will be tempted to attack the other in preemptive self-defense, and so on, freeing everyone from the Hobbesian trap. Today, for example, the Swedes don't stay up at night worrying that their neighbors are hatching plans for Norway über alles, or vice versa. The third condition for perpetual peace is universal hospitality, or world citizenship. People from one country should be free to live in safety in others, as long as they don't bring an army in with them. The hope is that communication, trade, and other peaceable relations across national boundaries will knit the world's people into a single community, so that a violation of rights in one place is felt throughout the world. Obviously, the satirist's deglorification of war and Kant's practical ideas on how to reduce it did not catch on widely enough to spare Western civilization the catastrophes of the next century and a half. But as we shall see, they planted the seeds of a movement that would blossom later and turn the world away from war. The new attitudes had an immediate impact as well. Historians have noted a change in the attitudes to war beginning around 1700. Leaders began to profess their love of peace and to claim that war had been forced upon them. As Mueller notes, No longer was it possible simply and honestly to proclaim like Julius Caesar, "I came, I saw, I conquered." Gradually, this was changed to, "I came, I saw. He attacked me while I was just standing there looking. I won." This might be seen as progress. More tangible progress was seen in the dwindling appeal of imperial power. In the 18th century, some of the world's most bellicose nations, such as the Netherlands, Sweden, Spain, Denmark, and Portugal, reacted to military disappointments not by doubling down and plotting a return to glory, but by dropping out of the conquest game, leaving war and empire to other countries and becoming commercial nations instead. One of the results, as we shall see in the next chapter, was that wars between great powers became shorter, less frequent, and limited to fewer countries, though the advance of military organization meant that the wars that did occur were more damaging. And the greatest progress was yet to come. The extraordinary decline of major war in the last 60 years may be a delayed vindication of the ivory tower theories of Immanuel Kant, if not perpetual peace, then certainly a long peace, and one that keeps getting longer. As the great thinkers of the Enlightenment predicted, we owe this peace not just to the belittling of war, but to the spread of democracy, the expansion of trade and commerce, and the growth of international organizations. Whence the humanitarian revolution? We have seen that in the span of just over a century, cruel practices that had been a part of civilization for millennia were suddenly abolished. The killing of witches, the torture of prisoners, the persecution of heretics, the execution of nonconformists, and the enslavement of foreigners, all carried out with stomach-churning cruelty, quickly passed from the unexceptionable to the unthinkable. Paine remarks on how difficult it is to explain these changes. The routes whereby uses of force are abandoned are often quite unexpected, even mysterious, so mysterious that one is sometimes tempted to allude to a higher power at work. Time and again one encounters violent practices so rooted and so self-reinforcing that it seems almost magical that they were overcome. One is reduced to pointing to history to explain how this immensely beneficial policy, a reduction in the use of force, has been gradually imposed on a human race that has neither consciously sought it nor agreed with it. One example of this mysterious unsought progress is the long-term trend away from using force to punish debtors, which most people never realized was a trend. Another is the way that political murder has faded in English-speaking countries well before the principles of democracy had been articulated. In cases like these, a nebulous shift in sensibilities may have been a prerequisite to consciously designed reforms. It's hard to imagine how a stable democracy can be implemented until competing factions give up the idea that murder is a good way to allocate power. The recent failure of democracy to take hold in many African and Islamic states is a reminder that a change in the norms surrounding violence has to precede a change in the nuts and bolts of governance. Still, a gradual shift in sensibilities is often incapable of changing actual practices until the change is implemented by the stroke of a pen. The slave trade, for example, was abolished as a result of moral agitation that persuaded men in power to pass laws and back them up with guns and ships. Blood sports, public hangings, cruel punishments, and debtors' prisons were also shut down by acts of legislators who had been influenced by moral agitators and the public debates they began. In explaining the humanitarian revolution, then, we don't have to decide between unspoken norms and explicit moral argumentation. Each affects the other. As sensibilities change, thinkers who question a practice are more likely to materialize, and their arguments are more likely to get a hearing and then catch on. The arguments may not only persuade the people who wield the levers of power, but infiltrate the culture's sensibilities by finding their way into barroom and dinner table debates, where they may shift the consensus one mind at a time. And when a practice is banished from everyday experience because it was outlawed from the top down, it may fall off the menu of live options in people's imaginations. Just as today, smoking in offices and classrooms has passed from commonplace to prohibited to unthinkable, practices like slavery and public hangings, when enough time passed that no one alive could remember them, became so unimaginable that they were no longer brought up for debate. The most sweeping change in everyday sensibilities left by the humanitarian revolution is the reaction to suffering in other living things. People today are far from morally immaculate. They may covet nice objects, fantasize about sex with inappropriate partners, or want to kill someone who has humiliated them in public. But other sinful desires no longer occur to people in the first place. Most people today have no desire to watch a cat burn to death, let alone a man or a woman. In that regard, we are different from our ancestors of a few centuries ago, who approved, carried out, and even savored the infliction of unspeakable agony on other living beings. What were these people feeling? And why don't we feel it today? We won't be equipped to answer this question until we plunge into the psychology of sadism in Chapter 8 and empathy in Chapter 9. But for now, we can look at some historical changes that militated against the indulgences of cruelty. As always, the challenge is to find an exogenous change that precedes the change in sensibilities and behavior, so we can avoid the circularity of saying that people stopped doing cruel things because they got less cruel. What changed in people's environment that could have set off the humanitarian revolution? The civilizing process is one candidate. Recall that Elias suggested that during the transition to modernity, people not only exercised more self-control, but also cultivated their sense of empathy. They did so not as an exercise in moral improvement, but to hone their ability to get inside the heads of bureaucrats and merchants and prosper in a society that increasingly depended on networks of exchange rather than farming and plunder. Certainly, the taste for cruelty clashes with the values of a cooperative society. It must be harder to work with your neighbors if you think they might enjoy seeing you disemboweled. And the reduction in personal violence brought about by the civilizing process may have lessened the demand for harsh punishments, just as today demands to get tough on crime rise and fall with the crime rate. Lynn Hunt, the historian of human rights, points to another knock-on effect of the civilizing process, the refinements in hygiene and manners, such as eating with utensils, having sex in private, and trying to keep one's effluvia out of view and off one's clothing. The enhanced decorum, she suggests, contributed to the sense that people are autonomous, that they own their bodies, which have an inherent integrity, and are not a possession of society. Bodily integrity was increasingly seen as worthy of respect, as something that may not be breached at the expense of the person for the benefit of society. My own sensibilities tend toward the concrete, and I suspect there is a simpler hypothesis about the effect of cleanliness on moral sensibilities. People got less repulsive. Humans have a revulsion to filth and bodily secretions, and just as people today may avoid a homeless person who reeks of feces and urine, people in earlier centuries may have been more callous to their neighbors because those neighbors were more disgusting. Worse, people easily slip from visceral disgust to moralistic disgust and treat unsanitary things as contemptibly defiled and sordid. Scholars of 20th century atrocities have wondered how brutality can spring up so easily when one group achieves domination over another. The philosopher Jonathan Glover has pointed to a downward spiral of dehumanization. People force a despised minority to live in squalor, which makes them seem animalistic and subhuman, which encourages the dominant group to mistreat them further, which degrades them still further, removing any remaining tug on the oppressor's conscience. Perhaps this spiral of dehumanization runs the movie of the civilizing process backwards. It reverses the historical sweep toward greater cleanliness and dignity that led, over the centuries, to greater respect for people's well-being. Unfortunately, the civilizing process and the humanitarian revolution don't line up in time in a way that would suggest that one caused